Welcome to our deep dive into a truly pivotal period in Indian history. The rise of the Indian National Congress and their fight for independence between 1900 and 1947.
It's a fascinating story, and you'll be surprised to learn that it's much more intricate than just India versus the British. We'll uncover how the Congress brought together a nation of incredible diversity, navigated the political landscape with the colonial powers, and ultimately achieved independence.
We have a really interesting mix of sources to guide us through this period: historical accounts, personal narratives, and even some architectural insights that reflect the shifting power dynamics. It's amazing how even something like architecture can tell a story.
It really does. What's especially fascinating is that the seeds of resistance were sown long before the Indian National Congress took center stage. You might remember our deep dive into the Battle of Plassey, while its aftermath saw the formation of groups like the Indian Association in Calcutta in 1876, led by Surendranath Banerjee.
So even before the Congress, there was this undercurrent of resistance building up.
Absolutely. Across India, local organizations began to emerge, voicing concerns and representing Indian interests. These weren't just political groups, they were literary societies, groups dedicated to education and social reform. For example, you had the Mahajana Sabha in Madras, founded in 1894, and the Pune Sarvajanik Sabha, which started even earlier in 1867.
It sounds like the ground was already fertile for a larger movement to take root.
Exactly. These groups, with their diverse approaches, built a foundation for a wider national movement, but they also had their differences. The Deccan Education Society, for instance, focused on education as a tool for empowerment, while the Pune Sarvajanik Sabha was more about engaging with the British administration.
So it wasn't just one unified voice from the start. It was more like a chorus of different perspectives, all with the shared goal of representing Indian interests.
Precisely. And this is where the Indian National Congress enters the scene. As the Congress rose to prominence, they had to perform a very delicate balancing act. They had to negotiate with the British while also mobilizing the Indian masses.
It sounds incredibly challenging, especially considering the diversity of India at the time. I mean, how do you unite communities with such different interests and aspirations under one banner?
That was perhaps their biggest challenge, and their strategies were often met with both praise and criticism. A prime example of this complexity is the 1916 Lucknow Pact. In this pact, the Congress agreed to separate electorates for Muslims, a move that aimed to build a broader coalition.
But wasn't that decision seen as divisive by some? How did the Congress reconcile that with their goal of unifying the nation?
That's a great question, and it highlights the tough choices they had to make. While some saw it as a necessary compromise, others viewed it as a concession that ultimately contributed to communal tensions down the line. The Lucknow Pact represents this push and pull between pragmatism and ideology that defined much of the Congress's early history.
It really underscores the difficult path they had to navigate, trying to appease multiple groups while also making progress towards independence.
Exactly. And you can see how this tension played out even in their unification tactics. They would organize mass protests and boycotts, but they also tapped into shared cultural symbols and stories from ancient epics like the Mahabharata.
Connecting a modern struggle to stories that have resonated for centuries, that's a powerful tactic. It's like drawing a direct line from India's past to its future.
It was, and they didn't stop there. They promoted indigenous industries like khadi, which became a symbol of self-reliance and a rejection of British goods.
Khadi was more than just cloth. It was a statement. But I imagine promoting it wasn't always easy. Was there pushback from those who were accustomed to British goods?
Absolutely. Think about it. Convincing people to switch to a locally produced cloth, often more expensive and less readily available, was no small feat. They had to make it a symbol of national pride, a tangible way for ordinary people to participate in the movement.
It really speaks to the persuasive power of the Congress and their ability to connect with people on a personal level. Did this strategy succeed in all parts of India?
The impact of the Khadi movement varied across regions. In some areas, it was enthusiastically embraced, while in others, it faced resistance due to local economic conditions and preferences. This further highlights the challenge of unifying such a vast and diverse nation.
So even within their successes, there were these regional variations and complexities. It really emphasizes the intricate nature of the independence movement.
Exactly. And to complicate matters further, while the Congress was trying to unify the nation, India was undergoing a massive transformation due to modernization introduced by the British.
It sounds like a paradox. Resisting British rule while also benefiting from the advancements they brought.
It was. This modernization brought new technologies, infrastructure, and even social reforms. But it also facilitated British control and often had unintended consequences. A great example is the introduction of railways in India.
Railways revolutionized travel and trade, but I can see how it could also be used to strengthen British control and facilitate the exploitation of resources.
Precisely. The railways became a symbol of this modernization paradox, representing both progress and exploitation. It made it even more difficult for the Congress to present a clear-cut narrative of resistance.
So the Congress had to contend with not just the British, but also the complex and often contradictory effects of modernization on Indian society. It sounds like they were facing challenges on multiple fronts.
Yes. And we haven't even touched upon the rise of other political groups with differing ideologies. For example, the Hindu Mahasabha, advocating for Hindu unity, emerged as a strong voice during this period.
And their stance, often rooted in religious nationalism, rejected concessions to other groups, which I imagine contributed to growing communal tensions.
You're right. Their rise highlights the fragmentation within the independence movement and foreshadows the eventual partition of India. This leads to a crucial question. Could India have achieved independence without the Congress's unifying role, or did their compromises ultimately contribute to the tragic partition?
That's a question that continues to be debated by historians. And it's something for you to ponder as we delve deeper into this period.
And as you think about these complexities, remember that history isn't just a collection of facts. It's a web of human stories, choices, and consequences that continue to shape our world today.
And speaking of human stories, let's move on to the next phase of our deep dive, where we explore the personal narratives of those caught in the midst of this tumultuous period.
Absolutely. We'll examine the intellectual debates, the philosophical shifts, and the everyday experiences that shaped this era.
The ideas and actions of key figures during this time continue to influence India's political and social landscape. We can't fully understand modern India without first understanding its journey to independence.
Now, shifting our focus to the political landscape, we can see that the call for self-rule intensified as the 20th century progressed. This led to some really interesting changes in the Indian National Congress's approach.
Yeah, I've read that the Congress went through a sort of transformation during this period, moving away from petitions and appeals towards a more assertive stance, ultimately demanding complete independence.
Exactly. In the early years, they focused on raising awareness, advocating for rights within the existing system, trying to influence British policy through constitutional means.
It sounds like they were playing a long game, hoping for gradual change.
Yes, but the pace of change was often frustratingly slow, leading to tensions within the Congress. Younger, more radical members wanted to take more direct action. Imagine waiting decades for basic rights. It's bound to create a desire for more immediate results.
I can see how that would lead to friction. Did these different viewpoints within the Congress affect their actions?
Absolutely. This debate between the moderates and the extremists is crucial to understanding the trajectory of the movement. And one event that really shifted the dynamics was the partition of Bengal in 1905.
Right, the partition. Wasn't it seen as a tactic by the British to divide and weaken the nationalist movement?
That's how it was perceived by many Indians. Officially, it was for administrative efficiency, but it sparked massive protests and really galvanized opposition to British rule. This is also when we see the rise of the Swadeshi movement.
The Swadeshi movement. Remind me, what was that about?
It went beyond just political protests. The Swadeshi movement promoted the boycott of British goods and encouraged people to support local industries. Khadi, the handspun cloth, became a powerful symbol of this movement.
So it was about economic self-reliance as a form of resistance. But Khadi wasn't the only focus, right? Weren't there challenges in promoting it throughout India?
You're right. Khadi represented a larger shift towards indigenous industries. It wasn't just about cloth, but about reclaiming control of their own economy. But yes, there were definitely challenges. Convincing people to switch from readily available and often cheaper British goods to local products wasn't easy.
I can imagine. It must have required a lot of persuasion and education.
Absolutely. It became a test of the Congress's ability to mobilize people. They had to make supporting local industries a patriotic act, a way to demonstrate national pride. They organized exhibitions, workshops, and even incorporated Khadi into their own attire to set an example.
So they were really putting their money where their mouth was.
Exactly. But the impact of the Swadeshi movement wasn't uniform across India. Some regions embraced it wholeheartedly, while others faced challenges due to existing economic structures and preferences.
It sounds like a classic example of how a national movement has to adapt to local context.
Precisely. The Congress was constantly navigating these complexities, trying to balance national goals with regional realities. Now, leading up to World War I, many Indian nationalists hoped their contributions to the war effort would lead to greater autonomy.
It sounds like a gamble. Putting faith in the British sense of fairness.
It was. And those hopes were dashed. The limited reforms offered after the war, along with repressive measures like the Rowlatt Act, fueled further discontent.
What was the Rowlatt Act exactly?
Yeah. It was a law that allowed the British government to imprison people without trial, essentially suspending basic legal rights. It was seen as a huge betrayal, especially after Indians had contributed so much during the war.
That must have been a turning point for many.
It was. This period also saw the rise of a figure who would transform the independence movement, Mahatma Gandhi.
Gandhi's philosophy of Satyagraha, which emphasized nonviolent resistance, completely changed the game, didn't it?
It absolutely did. Gandhi's arrival marked a new chapter for the Congress. His approach resonated deeply with the Indian people. He turned the Congress into a true mass movement, drawing in people from all walks of life.
He was able to mobilize people across religious, caste, and regional divides, wasn't he? That's remarkable.
He was a unifying force, and his strategy of nonviolent resistance put immense pressure on the British government. It also garnered international attention, highlighting the moral bankruptcy of colonial rule.
So Gandhi's approach had both internal and external impacts, making it much harder for the British to justify their continued presence in India.
Precisely. He launched a series of nonviolent campaigns throughout the 1920s and 1930s, demanding complete independence.
The non-cooperation movement, the civil disobedience movement, and the Quit India movement come to mind. These were met with harsh repression by the British, weren't they?
Yes, they were. But each campaign further exposed the brutality of the colonial regime and strengthened the resolve of the Indian people.
So these movements, despite facing severe consequences, chipped away at British authority and kept the issue of Indian independence in the spotlight.
Exactly. The world was changing, and the idea of colonial empires was becoming increasingly untenable. World War II further weakened the British Empire, and they finally agreed to grant India independence.
It was a long and difficult road, filled with sacrifices and setbacks. But ultimately, the spirit of the Indian people prevailed.
It's a testament to their resilience and their commitment to freedom. However, the story doesn't end there. The partition of India in 1947, while marking the end of British rule, also brought about one of the most tragic events in modern history.
The partition, a moment of both triumph and immense sorrow.
Indeed. The partition, along religious lines, led to unimaginable violence and displacement, leaving a deep wound on the subcontinent.
It's a stark reminder that freedom often comes at a very high price.
It also raises some really tough questions about the legacy of colonialism, the challenges of nation building, and the fragility of peace.
But amidst the tragedy, there is also a story of resilience and hope. The people of India, having endured centuries of foreign rule, finally emerged as a free nation, ready to shape their own destiny.
Their story serves as a powerful reminder of the human spirit's ability to overcome immense obstacles and strive for a better future.
Speaking of which, we haven't really touched upon the resistance movements that predate the Congress. How did those early acts of defiance shape the path towards independence?
You're right. Before the Congress became the dominant force, there were countless acts of resistance, big and small, that helped lay the groundwork for the larger movement.
It's inspiring to think about those early resistors, standing up to a powerful empire, fighting for their land and their way of life. What were some of the other forms of resistance that predate the Congress?
Well, we've discussed the role of local organizations, but these groups were often deeply connected to their communities. Drawing on local histories and traditions to mobilize people, it gave the resistance a very personal and relatable dimension.
So it wasn't just about grand political ideologies. It was about protecting what was close to home.
Exactly. And resistance wasn't always about open rebellion. There were countless acts of quiet defiance, subtle subversions of authority, everyday acts of resistance that chipped away at the foundation of British rule.
It's like a hidden transcript of resistance woven into the fabric of everyday life.
Precisely. And it's important to remember this aspect of the story. These individual acts of courage and defiance, often overlooked in grand narratives, played a crucial role in shaping the consciousness of the Indian people.
It's a testament to the power of the human spirit, even in the face of oppression, to find ways to resist and keep the flame of hope alive.
And that flame of hope would eventually burn bright, illuminating the path towards a free India. But that path wasn't just paved with political struggles. It was also shaped by the everyday experiences of millions of Indians who were grappling with profound changes in their lives.
We've talked about the big picture, the movements, the leaders, but what about the personal stories, the human impact of this struggle?
That's a crucial aspect of understanding this period. The independence movement wasn't just a political drama unfolding on a national stage. It was deeply intertwined with the lives of ordinary people. Families grappling with economic hardship, communities navigating social and cultural transformations, individuals trying to make sense of a rapidly changing world.
We've mentioned the Swadeshi movement and its economic implications, but what were some of the other ways that British policies affected the lives of ordinary Indians?
Well, British economic policies often prioritized the needs of the empire over the well-being of the Indian people. For example, the introduction of cash crops like cotton and indigo led to a shift away from traditional subsistence farming, making many farmers dependent on volatile global markets.
So decisions made in London were having a direct impact on the livelihoods of farmers in India.
Exactly. And while the growth of industrial centers created new opportunities, it also led to worker exploitation and a widening gap between the rich and the poor. It's a classic example of how economic policies can have unintended social consequences.
The modernization paradox we discussed earlier comes to mind. It seems like many of the advancements brought by the British also came with a heavy price.
That's a key takeaway from this period. The introduction of new technologies and infrastructure, while bringing some benefits, also reinforced British control and often exacerbated existing inequalities. It was a double-edged sword.
So alongside the political struggle, there was this parallel struggle for economic justice and social equality. And amidst all of this, there was a remarkable cultural awakening happening, a revival of traditional arts, the emergence of new literary movements, a rediscovery of ancient texts and philosophies.
This cultural resurgence was incredibly important. It was deeply intertwined with the growing sense of national pride and the desire for self-rule. Artists, writers, musicians, they were all using their creativity to imagine and articulate a vision for a free India.
The power of art to inspire and mobilize is undeniable.
Absolutely. Think about the impact of someone like Rabindranath Tagore, whose writings celebrated India's rich cultural heritage and offered a vision of a nation rooted in its own unique identity.
Tagore's work transcended political boundaries. It spoke to something deeper. A sense of shared identity and cultural pride.
Precisely. And this cultural awakening wasn't confined to the elite. It was happening at the grassroots level, with folk traditions being revitalized and new forms of popular culture emerging.
So it was a truly national phenomenon, a shared experience that helped forge a sense of unity and purpose.
And it's important to note that education played a vital role in this cultural and political transformation.
Education was a key battleground during this period, wasn't it? Both the British and the Indians recognized its power.
You're absolutely right. The British introduced a system of education in India that was, on one hand, designed to produce clerks and administrators for the colonial state. But on the other hand, it inadvertently created a generation of educated Indians who began to question the very foundations of British rule.
It's almost ironic, isn't it? They created the very tools that were used against them.
It is. Access to new ideas, exposure to Western political philosophies, and the critical thinking skills fostered by education all played a role in fueling the independence movement. It also led to the revitalization of indigenous systems of education, like the Gurukul system, which offered an alternative to the colonial model.
So there was this fascinating interplay between Western and indigenous forms of knowledge, each shaping the other.
Exactly. And it's crucial to remember that education wasn't just about acquiring knowledge. It was about empowerment. It was about giving people the tools to understand their situation, to articulate their aspirations, and to participate in the struggle for freedom.
Education became a weapon of resistance, a way to challenge colonial hegemony and reclaim control over their own destiny.
It's a powerful reminder of the transformative power of education, both for individuals and for societies. And speaking of transformative power, we can't forget the incredible contributions of women to the independence movement.
Their stories are often overlooked,
yeah,
but their roles were absolutely essential.
Absolutely. Women were at the forefront of many protests and movements. They organized boycotts, provided support to underground activists, and raised awareness in their communities. They defied societal norms and risked their safety to fight for their nation's freedom.
We often hear about figures like Sarojini Naidu, the poet and activist who became one of the first women presidents of the Indian National Congress.
Sarojini Naidu was an incredible leader, but there were countless others. Women like Aruna Asaf Ali, who hoisted the Indian flag during the Quit India movement, Rani Lakshmibai, the legendary queen who fought against the British in the 1857 uprising, and so many more whose names might not be as well known, but whose contributions were no less significant.
Their courage and determination paved the way for greater gender equality in independent India. It's a reminder that the fight for freedom and the fight for equality are often intertwined.
You're right. The leaders of the independence movement understood that a truly free India required the emancipation of women. They saw the dismantling of colonial structures and the dismantling of social hierarchies that oppressed women as two sides of the same coin.
So the fight for India's freedom was also a fight for gender equality, a struggle that continues to this day. And speaking of ongoing struggles, we can't ignore the shadow cast by the partition.
The partition of India in 1947 was a moment of both triumph and immense tragedy. The birth of two independent nations, India and Pakistan, marked the end of British rule. But it also unleashed one of the most devastating events in modern history.
The violence, the displacement, the loss of life. The scars of partition run deep.
It's a stark reminder of the human cost of division and the fragility of peace. A wound that continues to shape the relationship between India and Pakistan to this day.
But even amidst the tragedy, there's a story of resilience. The people of India and Pakistan, having endured the horrors of partition, have also shown remarkable strength in rebuilding their lives and their nations.
Their story is a testament to the enduring human spirit and the hope for a future where peace and cooperation can prevail.
So as we come to the end of our deep dive into India's journey to independence, we're left with a mix of emotions. Awe at the courage and determination of those who fought for freedom, sorrow for the tragic consequences of division, and hope for a better future.
It's a story that reminds us that the fight for freedom and justice is never truly over. It's a struggle that continues in different forms across the globe, inspiring us to raise our voices, challenge injustice, and work towards a more equitable and compassionate world.
It's also a story that reminds us that history is not just a collection of facts and dates. It's a living narrative that shapes who we are and how we understand the world around us.
The journey to Indian independence, with all its complexities and contradictions, offers valuable lessons about the power of collective action, the importance of empathy and understanding, and the enduring belief in the possibility of a better future.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into one of the most pivotal periods in human history.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and never stop learning.